The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and from other Harvard publications. First, we're going to turn to the Harvard Heart Letter of March 2023. And the first article is entitled, Statins versus Supplements, A Reckoning. A study showed that statins lowered harmful LDL cholesterol better than dietary supplements. Whether and when you need statins is another question. Your recent blood test shows that your LDL or bad cholesterol is on the high side. Do you take a prescription cholesterol-lowering statin or choose a dietary supplement that supports heart health from the myriad on display at your local drugstore? Many people choose the latter, which is a source of great consternation for most cardiologists. Why would people shun an inexpensive, safe medication in favor of capsules made from unregulated products in bottles labeled with vague promises? These concerns inspired a recent study. The results clearly show that if you need to lower your LDL, a statin works and supplements do not, says Dr. Christopher Cannon, editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. Cardiologists usually see only people who already have heart disease, and for most of them, statins are a good idea because they lower the risk of a repeat heart attack by 30%. But what about people without heart disease? Simply having elevated LDL cholesterol doesn't necessarily mean you should be taking a statin, says Dr. Cannon. He uses a person's risk score on the American College of Cardiology's risk calculator, which is available at www.health.harvard.edu/ASCVD to start a discussion about whether taking a statin makes sense. People with a 10-year cardiovascular disease risk of greater than 5% might consider a statin, which the guidelines recommend for people with scores of 7.5% or higher, he explains. But he and other physicians agree that healthy habits, especially following a plant-focused diet and getting regular exercise, should be the foundation of lowering heart disease risk. For people without heart disease, lowering LDL is not an emergency. I give my patients 6 months to get a good plan in place and then see how their LDL responds to lifestyle changes, says Dr. Donald Levy, medical director of the Osher Clinical Center for Integrative Health at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. For some people, starting a statin reduces their incentive to exercise and eat well. Rather than focusing on different ways to minimize their cardiovascular risk, including managing stress and getting sufficient sleep, they worry only about reaching a specific LDL target. Integrative medicine relies on a combination of well-researched conventional and alternative therapies, with a focus on healing the whole person. People who seek out this type of care are motivated to try non-drug options for a variety of reasons, says Dr. Levy. For example, some of them don't trust big pharma. Others are sensitive to medications in general and want to avoid them when possible. Dr. Levy's advice may include dietary supplements like red yeast rice and plant sterols, but only under a doctor's supervision and using products tested and vetted by ConsumerLab.com, an independent testing company. Of note, the red yeast rice brand used in the recent study contains none of the active ingredient, a naturally occurring statin-like substance, Dr. Levy points out. What's more, with the exception of red yeast rice and plant sterols, None of the other supplements used in the study are even known to affect LDL. Taking cinnamon, garlic, or turmeric to lower cholesterol does not make sense, he says. You simply can't trust supplement labels, a problem the FDA is attempting to address. However, Dr. Levy also prescribes statins when appropriate and notes that compared to other statins, rosuvastatin or Crestor is less likely to interact with other medications. Potentially harmful interactions are another reason Dr. Cannon is wary about dietary supplements, some of which can interact with heart medications. For example, high-dose garlic supplements may slightly raise bleeding risk when taken with anti-clotting medications like warfarin or clopidogrel, which is also called Plavix. So, after age 45 if you're a man, or 55 if you're a woman, get a blood cholesterol test every 1 to 2 years. Use the results to assess your risk and talk to your doctor, advises Dr. Cannon. Discuss whether you need treatment and figure out together what works. But don't just try something natural on your own, he says. Attached to this article is a short article that's entitled Unproven Claims on Supplements for Heart Disease. And it says, in November of 2022, the FDA issued warning letters to 7 companies for selling supplements that claimed to prevent or treat cardiovascular disease. The agents released the following statement. Given that cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, it's important that the FDA protect the public from products and companies that make unlawful claims to treat it. Dietary supplements that claim to cure, treat, mitigate, or prevent cardiovascular disease and related conditions could potentially harm consumers who use these products instead of seeking safe and effective FDA-approved treatments from qualified healthcare providers. Now we're going to continue in the Harvard Heart Letter. Again, this is the March 2023 issue. The Harvard Heart Letter now has a new chief medical editor, who is Dr. Howard Lewine, and has a new editor-in-chief, Dr. Christopher Cannon. The next article in the Harvard Heart Letter is entitled The New Diabetes Drugs. Your best shot for weight loss? Injectable medications that mimic natural gut hormones may also lower heart-related risks. Here's what you need to know about these revolutionary drugs. A weekly injection that leads to dramatic weight loss without serious side effects almost sounds too good to be true. But several drugs originally developed to treat type 2 diabetes can help people shed as much as 20% of their body weight, far more than other anti-obesity drugs. Known as incretin mimetics, that's I-N-C-R-E-T-I-N, they also improve blood pressure and cholesterol levels. Not surprisingly, these medications are in high demand, especially semaglutide. This has led to shortages of certain formulations. That's just one of the issues faced by people hoping to take these drugs, which cost $1,000 to $1,500 per month and are not covered by Medicare for obesity. Who's a good candidate, and what else should people know about them? Up to half of all new onset diabetes in this country is linked to obesity, a disease that now affects more than 40% of Americans. Both conditions are closely linked to cardiovascular disease. Many cardiologists now recognize that treating obesity is the best way to treat heart disease, says Dr. Caroline Apovian, who co-directs the Center for Weight Management and Wellness at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Other anti-obesity drugs help people lose only about 5 to 8% of their body weight. But the incretin mimetics, which are similar to hormones made naturally by the gut and brain, have multiple effects. They prod the pancreas to release insulin when blood sugar rises too high, slow down the emptying of the stomach, and target brain receptors involved in reducing appetite. The newest ones, tirzepatide and semaglutide, can lead to remarkable weight loss and also lower hemoglobin A1C levels, a three-month average measure of the blood sugar, by as much as 2 percentage points. Studies also show that semaglutide and liraglutide, an older drug, can lower the risk of serious cardiovascular problems, like heart attack and stroke, in people with obesity and diabetes, says Dr. Apovian. A large trial to see whether semaglutide lowers heart-related risk in people without diabetes who are overweight or obese is currently underway. So who should consider these drugs? Well, people with diabetes who are carrying excessive weight are good candidates for semaglutide or tirzepatide, especially those at high risk for heart disease, Dr. Apovian says. For people without diabetes, the official criteria for prescribing the drugs are the same as for all other anti-obesity drugs. The body mass index needs to be 30 or higher, or there needs to be a BMI of 27 and at least one weight-related health problem, like high blood pressure or high cholesterol. Taking these drugs involves injecting yourself in the abdomen or thigh using a pen-like device with a tiny needle the size of a human hair. Side effects like nausea, diarrhea, and constipation are common, but they rarely last longer than a week or so, especially if you start low and increase the dosage slowly, while guided by an experienced physician, says Dr. Apovian. If you stop taking the drug, you'll likely regain weight, but that's similar to what would happen if you were taking blood pressure medication and stopped. Your blood pressure would rise. Obesity is a disease, and we need to treat it like one, says Dr. Apovian. Attached to this article is a brief section entitled Diabetes and Anti-Obesity Drugs. Poisonous lizards known as Gila monsters have a unique ability to maintain steady blood sugar even after long stretches of not eating. Venom from this colorful creature inspired the development of exenatide or Byetta, the first in a series of drugs known as incretin mimetics. Today, there are more effective drugs that mimic incretin called GLP-1. These injectable drugs include dulaglutide or Trulicity, liraglutide or Victoza, and semaglutide or Ozempic. The latter is also available as a pill called Rybelsus. Liraglutide, that's Victoza, and semaglutide or Ozempic are also approved for weight loss, but they're given different names. They're called Saxenda and Wegovy. The newest addition to this drug family combines GLP-1 and another incretin mimic, GIP. An example of this is tirzepatide or Mounjaro, which was approved for treating type 2 diabetes in May 2022 and tagged for accelerated review for approval to treat obesity, which is anticipated in 2023. Again, that drug is tirzepatide or Mounjaro. Now we're going to briefly go over some research we're watching. And the first article is entitled Heavy Metals Found in Popular Brands of Dark Chocolate. Because dark chocolate is a rich source of beneficial plant compounds called flavanols, it's often touted as a heart-healthy treat. But many popular brands of dark chocolate contain potentially worrisome levels of lead and cadmium, according to a study by the Consumer Reports published in December 2022. Consistent long-term exposure to even low levels of either of these heavy metals has been linked to various health problems, including cardiovascular disease. Researchers used California's maximum allowable dose levels for lead, which is 0.5 micrograms, and cadmium, which is 4.1 micrograms, to gauge the risk posed by dark chocolate. For 23 of the 28 chocolate bars they tested, eating 1 ounce per day would put an adult over the maximum dose for one of these heavy metals. Five bars contained levels over the limit for both lead and cadmium. Chocolate, which is made from the seeds of the cacao tree, can be contaminated with cadmium and lead by polluted soil, not only as the crop grows, but also during harvesting and processing. You can limit your exposure by choosing dark chocolate brands that Consumer Report deemed as safer options. And these are listed at www.health.harvard.edu/DARKCHOC. Now we're going to discuss telehealth for your heart. Again, from the Harvard Heart Letter of March 2023. Virtual visits and remote monitoring can be convenient, cost-effective ways to enhance your cardiovascular care. Seeing and speaking with a doctor via smartphone, tablet, or computer from the comfort of your own home became commonplace during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. Over the past year or so, in-person healthcare visits have rebounded, but video visits and other forms of telehealth can still be a good option for treating people with heart disease, according to a scientific statement from the American Heart Association that was published in December 2022 in Circulation. What we're seeing now is an increase of blended care that includes a combination of in-person and virtual visits, says cardiologist Dr. Amy Bott, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Chief Innovation Officer for the American College of Cardiology. Healthcare systems that established infrastructure to integrate virtual healthcare into their practices have had the most success with a hybrid model. For both patients and clinicians, it's important to pay attention to specific needs, preferences, and comfort levels with different types of care, she says. Types of telehealth. Telehealth can be delivered in any of three ways. The first way is synchronous, when the doctor communicates with the patient in real time via phone or an internet-connected device. The next one is asynchronous, when information is exchanged between doctors and patients, but not in real time, like an email communication. Then there is remote monitoring, when measurements like weight, blood pressure, or EKG are sent to the clinician through wirelessly connected devices. Even before the pandemic, most medical practices had internet-based portals that people used to make appointments and receive test results. These portals often serve as the gateway to synchronous visits, which are ideally suited for much of the care needed by people who have or are at risk for heart disease. For example, doctors often review information from various measurements or tests you've done at home or from a lab, and then discuss any lifestyle or medication changes you can make to better manage your condition. Many studies have shown that telehealth care can lead to significant improvement in heart-related risk factors, especially lowering blood pressure, as the AHA statement notes. Currently, asynchronous communications between doctors and patients tend to originate from the medical practice and usually include things like questionnaires or reminders about screenings or tests. But if people shared information through a portal prior to a virtual visit, that would leave more time for discussion, Dr. Bott says. For people with heart failure, a smart scale that wirelessly transmits data can flag small weight increases that may signal the need for medication adjustment. Other options for monitoring include smartwatches or other devices that track your heart rate and check for heart rhythm abnormalities with a simple EKG, which you can then pass on to your physician. But while doctors are becoming comfortable prescribing these digital tools, they're not a smart choice for everyone. These days, there's a lot of health-related anxiety, and over-measuring can contribute to this problem, says Dr. Bott. Make sure you understand when and why, and how often self-monitoring makes sense for you, she advises. People with heart disease who need routine check-ins often appreciate the convenience of virtual visits, which eliminate travel and waiting time. But there are times that sitting together in the same room is best, even when you don't need a physical exam. Finding the right blend of telehealth and in-person care is the future we're slowly moving toward. And the article also adds, make the most of your virtual health care visit. The doctor's office will give you instructions about the software program you need for your computer. You'll also need a reliable internet connection. Here are some additional tips. Make sure your device is charged or plugged in. Set up your device in a private, quiet room, ideally with a light source that illuminates your face. Angle the camera so the doctor can see you well. If you're using a smartphone, prop it up so you're not holding it in your hand. Log on to your appointment 5 to 10 minutes early to leave time to troubleshoot any connection issues. Have a phone available as a backup in case the video doesn't work. Otherwise, prepare as you would for an in-person visit. Have a list of questions and a pen and paper to take notes. Now we're going to go over a couple of other things under Research We're Watching in the Harvard Heart Letter of March 2023. Stopping unneeded aspirin may prevent dangerous bleeding. Many people who take the clot-preventing drug warfarin may also take aspirin, despite not having a clear reason to do so. A new study suggests that if doctors identify these people and take them off aspirin, it may prevent dangerous bleeding. The study included more than 6,700 people who were taking warfarin to treat blood clots in the veins, venous thromboembolism, or prevent clots from atrial fibrillation, along with low-dose aspirin. Researchers then asked the participants' primary care doctor to review whether their patients had a specific reason for taking aspirin, and if not, to discuss stopping it. Aspirin raises the risk of bleeding, especially when taken with warfarin. So current guidelines recommend low-dose aspirin for only certain people, mainly those who've already had a heart attack. Among the people who didn't need it, aspirin use dropped 47%. During the two-year study, the risk of bleeding complications went down by 32%. Among those who stopped aspirin. The findings were published in the September 2022 issue of JAMA Network Open and reinforced the importance of talking with your doctor about whether you should start or stop taking low-dose aspirin. And now here's a final article from the section called Research We're Watching, in the Harvard Heart Letter of March 2023. And it says, most Americans need a large or extra-large blood pressure cuff. To get an accurate blood pressure reading using the right size cuff, The part that inflates and squeezes the upper arm is very important. Because of rising obesity rates in this country, a majority of people now need a large or extra-large blood pressure cuff. They came to this conclusion in a study of November 2022 in the American Journal of Hypertension. Adult cuff sizes are based on a measurement of the mid-arm circumference. They include small, up to 26 centimeters, regular, more than 26 centimeters, up to 34 centimeters, and large, more than 34 centimeters, up to 44 centimeters, as well as extra large, which is more than 44 centimeters. For the report, researchers measured the arms of a representative sample of more than 13,000 people in the United States. They found that over half the men, 53%, and one-third of women, 34%, required a large or extra-large cuff. Only 2% of men and 10% of women needed a small cuff. Many home blood pressure machines come with variable-sized cuffs that can be adjusted to arms 22 to 42 centimeters in circumference. Remember that extra large is more than 44 centimeters. Measure around your arm to make sure the cuff you're using is the correct size to ensure accurate blood pressure reading. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Yunk, and reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.